Hello and welcome to the Young Fabians podcast. Today we're joined by the new chair of the Fabian Society, Martin Edebor. He is going to be introducing himself to the Young Fabians and beyond, and we're going to talk a bit about what his plans are for the Fabian Society for the next year, as well as a bit about his background, a bit about his experiences running as a candidate in the last election, and all about the future of the Labour Party and Fabianism. So, hi Martin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Louis. I'm a huge fan of the Young Fabian podcast and an avid listener, so I'm really glad to be here today.
Amazing. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. I should also say we're also joined by Marie. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good.
Nice. And Marie's back to co-host on this episode. So yeah, pleasure to have you also, Marie. Let's crack on. So first of all, Martin, congratulations on being elected as chair of the Fabian Society. Before we get into that, I'd like to know a bit about sort of your experience over the years within the Fabian Society. I'd like to know a bit about the sort of different roles you've held, how you came into the Fabian Society and the Young Fabians, and just about the sort of journey from joining the Young Fabians to being the chair.
Thank you, Louis and Marie. I'll have to go a bit back. And basically, it all starts back in 2009 when I was a medical student at University College London. And I had just commenced my third year intercalating in medical anthropology at the time. And I was a member of the University College London Labour Society and, enjoyed my time there and joined the Labour Party. At the same time, I joined the Fabian Society. And what drew me to the Fabian Society was an event I had attended that year in which David Miliband was speaking to the Young Fabians. And I was just taken aback and really impressed by, all the really bright young people in the room, the way the event was organized, and also how warm and welcoming everyone was. I wasn't really involved in student politics at the time. I was really put off by student politics, actually. And this was just a breath of fresh air. The Young Fabians seemed like a really warm place to be. So I continued to attend events and gradually got more and more active. And in 2011, I co-founded with a few other Young Fabians, the Young Fabian Health Network, and was elected the inaugural chair. Following a few attempts, I stood for the Young Fabian exec and was co-opted onto the Young Fabian exec in 2012. And following that, the year after, was elected onto the Young Fabian exec in 2013-14, where I served as treasurer of the Young Fabians. And from 2014 to 15, I then served as vice chair, and 15 to 16 was elected chair of the Young Fabians. At the same time, was completing my kind of medical school studies, and then ended up moving to the East Midlands to work as a junior doctor, which I really, really enjoyed, while being on the exec. And then I took a year out, 2015 to 2016, to do a master's while chairing the Young Fabians, which is a phenomenal experience. During my time in the Young Fabians, I developed some amazing friendships, which I still hold dear today. I also learned a huge amount about politics, public policy, the policy-making process, an experience I would not have gained otherwise if it wasn't for the Young Fabians. It was very much a a space, a safe space to develop ideas, to try trial and error, to discuss, ways we can contribute to public policy and hopefully to a Labour government, which didn't happen in 2015, but it was a phenomenal experience. And, you know, I encourage as many people to get involved in the Young Fabians, because it's the place where, you know, thinking occurs and, you know, future leaders, policymakers, politicians are, find their feet and, you know, are able to learn and develop. So I had a phenomenal time in the Young Fabians, and following that, specialised in general practice, continued to be involved in Fabian Society, stood for the exec, and now I'm here as chair.
So you're a doctor in the NHS, and I'm just wondering how has your career as a medical professional, how has this shaped your views of politics?
Mary, thanks for that question. For me, you know, currently I'm a GP in East London, and I'm really honoured to, be the clinical director for North Newham Primary Care Network, which is a collection of three GP practices looking after around 35,000 people. And my experience as an NHS doctor, as a healthcare professional, has shaped every aspect of my politics. What drove me to get involved in the Labour Party and the Young Fabians was very much my desire to help to reduce health and social inequality. I grew up in Stratford, East London, the same location I work today. And growing up knowing that people who were born and grew up in the area that I was from had lower life expectancy compared to other people in other parts of London, I thought that was a huge injustice and something we needed to correct. And what drives me is this desire to change things for the better and for a large number of people. And I realized while I was at medical school that as a doctor, there's only so much you can do by yourself. If you want to help a large number of people, for example, help, you know, trying to improve health outcomes and reduce health inequality, you need to work within systems and you need to work in partnership with other people and other groups. And I see the Labour Party as a huge, you know, one of the best vehicles in our country historically and currently for progressive systemic change. So I saw the organisations like the Fabian Society, like Labour Party, as a great route to help to reduce health and social inequality. And through my experience of getting involved, I realised, not only is building a movement and networks important, but also the huge central role of legislation and public policy. And when you have power or a government which is happy to enact policies and laws, which leads to progressive change, in addition to having a wider movement backing that, it can lead to really positive and profound change. So for me, my profession drives my politics and has shaped my views. In addition to that, in turn, my experience in the Fabian Society and Fabianism has had a parallel additional effect as well.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Like, I completely understand what you mean about how your profession can kind of almost reaches a limit in how many people that it affects until you have to think of it on a policy level above just following the policies. So in the Fabian Society, what are some examples of policy ideas and work on policy that you've done in the area of health and social care and the NHS?
Thank you, Marie. So one of the things that we do in the Fabian Society and we've been doing since 18, 1984, is producing policy pamphlets, policy papers, and trying to influence the wider public discourse. My first sort of major policy sort of project within the Fabian Society was, you know, while I was a Young Fabian member and while I was involved in the Young Fabian Health Network. In 2012, the Health Network led a series of policy roundtables, which was looking specifically at the funding mechanism around health and social care. If you recall back then, at the time, we had the awful Health and Social Care Bill being pushed forward by Andrew Lansley, the then Health Secretary, under the David Cameron government, which was massively disliked by the health professions, including doctors and nurses, which looked to reorganise the healthcare system. And we were looking at trying to develop a health and social care system that was appropriately funded in a sustainable manner. So we launched this series of policy roundtables, and it culminated in an event in May 2013, in which Andy Burnham, the then Shadow Secretary of State for Health, set out Labour's vision for a sustainable social care system. And we also put together a policy pamphlet, which I edited with another Young Fabian at the time, Daniel Wilson Craw, called Irreversible Health and Social Care Policy in a Post-Coalition Landscape. It was the 61st policy pamphlet in the Young Fabian's historical series. And that was the sort of first policy project I was involved in. And it was looking to push forward a whole person care approach, trying to ensure that there was sustainable funding for both the health and social care sectors, trying to introduce a parity of esteem between health, social care and mental health. And following that, Andy Burnham, as you know, and the Labour Party moved forward with this whole person care approach. Sadly, he didn't win the 2015 general election and things went in a different direction. But that is politics, and you know, there's not much we can do about that. That was, you know, what one of the policy projects I was in. And another, you know, policy paper I was involved in was a policy project called Closing the Gap, which I worked with another Young Fabian at the time, Sophie Kinneyside. And, you know, we looked at how the healthcare system could be remoulded to ensure it was fit to face the challenges of the new century. And that was published in, I think, 2014. And, you know, we were taking a deep look in how the Labour Party can deliver a world-class comprehensive healthcare service that was able to meet the challenges of a growing population. And that built on the previous pamphlet that was released the year before. Those were while I was, you know, in the Young Fabians. And more recently, I was involved in a policy project with the Fabian Society Health Policy Group, in which we launched a publication called Fabian Perspectives on Mental Health. You know, with the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, we know the huge amount of impact it's had on the nation's mental health. And it was launched in July 2020. And we had contributions from a range of people, including Anas Sawa, the Glasgow MSP. We also had Professor Wendy Byrne, now Dame Wendy Byrne, who talked about solving the mental health workforce crisis, Kevin Jones MP, also the current Mayor Andy Burnham on transforming mental health in Greater Manchester. Being in the Young Fabians was a fantastic experience because it gave me a chance to contribute to really interesting policy papers and to continue to sort of, contribute to wider public policy debate.
Amazing. Thanks, Martin, for the answer. I want to sort of follow up on a few of the points there, especially with regards to COVID. I think you know, that's something that can't be avoided. You know, we've got you a medical professional on the podcast. It's inevitable that we'll talk about COVID. So let's just get that out of the way. I want to know, in sort of a policy sense, no question that had we come into this pandemic with a Labour government, things would be very different, you know, in terms of NHS funding and staffing and supply and all of those things. But also, you know, as you say, mental health, you know, care for older people, these different areas which, you know, the Tories have been failing for the past 10 years. I want to know sort of what you think about how has COVID changed or sort of affected your sort of ideas on sort of like developing and also communicating like ideas about the NHS and communicating the importance of the NHS. I think a lot of people who didn't realise beforehand now realise the importance of having a fully funded healthcare system. Yeah, I just want to sort of get your thoughts on that.
Thank you, Louis. First of all, you know, it's important to acknowledge that the COVID-19 pandemic is a crisis like we've never seen before. As we currently speak, we are seeing the highest number of recorded deaths since the onset of this pandemic. In addition to that, we have a National Health Service that's been overwhelmed with cases. We have a test, track, and trace system that is simply not working. In addition to that, we've seen huge heroic efforts from health and social care staff, key workers, working to ensure that our country keeps going. On top of that, we have seen an effort like no other in the development of 3 vaccines, the Moderna, the Oxford AstraZeneca, and Pfizer vaccine, which is providing a glimmer and ray of hope in an otherwise chaotic crisis. Louis, you mentioned, and you know, in your question, you make a really important observation around how the National Health Service is perceived. Right now, this crisis has shown the absolute importance and bedrock that our National Health Service is for our nation. We have a healthcare system that is free at the point of need, funded by general taxation. You know, it has withstood the test of time, and in this moment in crisis is stepping up. As I speak in Newham, the area I work, Newham Health Collaborative, Newham CCG, Primary Care Networks are working round the clock to vaccinate as many people as possible within the cohort guidance that the government has set out. We should be not only thankful, but, you know, we should very much look at how we can strengthen our healthcare service going forward. On top of that, the COVID-19 pandemic has revealed to us as a nation the underlying health and social inequality that pre-exist and predate COVID. We've seen how those inequality has exacerbated wider issues within this crisis. For example, Black, Asian, and minority ethnic people are at higher risk of catching COVID and dying from COVID. We've seen key workers put their lives at risk and the lives of their loved one at risk in going out and working day in, day out. And from this crisis, we now need a new consensus going forward. The old orthodoxies of the notion that we cannot fund the NHS in a certain way, we cannot fund free school meals, we cannot implement certain policies because of the deficit or because of our economy. We now see that if there is political will, we can introduce huge amount of systemic change. Overnight, we saw how the Chancellor in subsequent budgets has gone above and beyond to, you know, ensure that we keep the economy going, although huge critiques remain around his approach. So for me, above all, this crisis has led to us needing a new way to how we both govern the United Kingdom, but how we view economic policy and how we view public sector investment going forward.
Absolutely spot on, Martin. I totally agree. And I think one thing that I'm really interested about with you, Martin, one thing I'd love to know more about is you stood in a general election as a Labour candidate in 2019 in Witham, which is actually Priti Patel's seat, is that right? How was that? How was that experience?
Louis, you know, first of all, it was an absolute honour and privilege to represent the Labour Party and be a parliamentary candidate in Witham, Essex. And, you know, they have a very vibrant and dynamic constituency Labour Party. You know, I got to make some amazing friends and build awesome relationships. Huge thanks goes out to Eileen and Pete from the CLP, who acted as my campaigners and agents. And also huge shout out to Kieran Dunn, who was coordinating my campaign on the ground. It was a phenomenal experience. First of all, to stand in a general election is, you know, a huge privilege. You get to speak to members of the public and to put forward and make a case for why your political party should get the honour of obtaining their votes. First of all, it was obviously a difficult and challenging election. The Labour Party was going into the election with a leader at the time who was not perceived in the best light by the public at large. On top of that, the central theme of the general election was around Brexit and delivering on that referendum result, which put the Labour Party in a difficult position. And I was standing in a what we can describe as a safe Conservative seat, which has never been held by a Labour candidate in the seat's short history, and against a Home Secretary who has an interesting reputation. So, you know, my main aim in the campaign was really to raise the vote, in addition to engage the local CLP and members and just try to get Labour's message across on the doorstep. You know, what I say to people who are really interested in sort of standing for council or for even parliamentary seats, I always encourage them. It's a great experience. It's phenomenal to be able to speak to members of the public, to partake in the democratic process, and to just embed yourself in a community. Overall, I love the experience. It's something that if you are interested in standing for public office, I highly recommend you do. And it's something, you know, I definitely would do again. And one thing to add, what was phenomenal in that campaign is that you had Young Fabian members and Fabian Society members standing in constituencies across the country. And we kind of formed a network of camaraderie and, you know, we kept each other going. And, you know, that's one additional thing I love about this society is that not only are we a political think tank, a membership organization, but we are a movement rooted in Fabian history. And, you know, that translates itself to the campaign process as well.
I think we definitely want to hear a bit more about, a lot of us like to say, the sort of the rise of Fabianism, especially within the Labour Party. And I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts about the future of the Labour Party and about the you know, the current leadership and the direction the party is going in. But before we get to that, I want to sort of ask about what your feelings were on election night when that exit poll came in. And you know, was it something you saw coming? Was it something you predicted from, you know, your time campaigning and going around on the doorsteps? Or was it a total shock? How did you feel, Martin?
So, obviously, just to kind of recognise this, December 12th, 2019, was the worst general election result in the Labour Party history since 1935. You know, it was historically a horrendous result for our party and our movement. It was very clear going into that general election that we were going to lose, and we were going to lose big. As a Labour candidate on the ground, knocking on doors, there was a frustration, not directed at the party as a whole, but mainly directed at the leadership at the time. And a lot of the criticisms was around three main areas. First of all, the anti-Semitism crisis that gripped our party, and the lack of ability of the leadership at the time to clamp down and rid our party of that absolute disgusting virus. Second was the view that the leadership at the time could not be viewed as being serious in government or seen as a serious party of government. And the third was around the perceived worldview of, you know, the Labour Party leadership. So there was a general perspective among some of the members of the public I met on campaign trail who thought that Jeremy Corbyn specifically held a worldview that was anti-British, that perceived the UK as being, or the UK and UK institutions as being inherently bad. And that perception came from, you know, Corbyn and his history in our sort of movement, and that perception then related to their view of the direction of the party, and coupled together with the fact that Brexit largely was on the ballot, and, you know, we didn't really have a clear sort of position, that indecisiveness fueled itself in leading to a horrendous defeat. The thing about what occurred was that, you know, it wasn't completely inevitable, but we were always heading in that direction. And I wrote an article recently for the Young Fabian blog in which I articulated the following things. You know, the previous 5 years, we saw a huge amount of progress halted by a particular faction who got grip of the Labour Party and Labour Party institutions. And they believed wrongly that they could achieve seismic change by rupturing with our party's past. Our party is rooted in the political philosophy that underpins Fabianism, that is, achieving progressive change through the parliamentary process, and doing that by, you know, gaining not only the consent of the public, but also understanding that progressive change occurs in a pluralistic nature. But for that sort of faction, it was not about the Labour movement as a whole, but it was about their faction and what they could achieve. And they cared more about holding power within the party than actually governing. And as a result, the only thing they really achieved was the most hard right government in our nation's history, gaining an 80 seat majority. And as a result, the people who are punished are the very people that the Labour Party are trying to represent. And for us going forward, we need to reflect and learn from that. The only time that the Labour Party is successful is when we are a broad church, in that we are trying to reach out to undecided voters, that we are trying to convert Tory voters, Lib Dem voters, Green voters to the Labour Party. And we're not just speaking to ourselves, but speaking to our country. And that's why I'm so positive in seeing the direction that Keir has taken us. You know, I think he's taking us in the right direction. He's saying the right things, and he's rebuilding the Labour movement to be pluralistic and to be outward looking once again.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. So it's been over a year since Labour failed in December 2019. So how do you think with this new leadership, with Keir Starmer, how do you think things have changed in the Labour Party?
Yeah, so Mary, that's a really good question. First of all, just to make clear, I supported Keir Starmer in the leadership campaign and, you know, also worked on his campaign in a voluntary capacity. I think Keir Starmer has done a wonderful job. First of all, he's taken leadership in providing a robust, clear response to anti-Semitism and making it clear that the Labour Party has a zero policy on anti-Semitism. You know, it will not be tolerated. It will be eliminated in our party. And that is something that was lacking under the previous Labour Party leadership. The second thing that Keir is doing is that he is rebuilding the party again from the ground up, ensuring that we are organisationally ready to fight the next general election, and has built a phenomenal team around him in the shadow cabinet. He's got Annalise Dodds as Shadow Chancellor, who is phenomenal and leading the charge. He's also got great Labour MPs like Kate Green, Shadow Education Secretary. He's got Seema Malhotra, Wes Streeting, you know, phenomenal people in the front bench. And he's very much building a team which looks like a government in waiting. And the final thing is around language and rhetoric. Keir Starmer is now speaking and, you know, appealing to a broader range of people across the country. He is looking outwards and he's looking forward, not backwards. And, you know, that is where our party needs to go. If we are to form the next government, we need to appeal to as much people as possible, but we also need to build a vision for the United Kingdom that is not only inclusive, but optimistic. And I believe Keir Starmer is doing that. And as a result, I believe he's setting the stage for the Labour Party to potentially win the next general election and hopefully govern in the next parliament.
So a lot of the shadow ministers you just mentioned are also Fabian Society members. How important do you think this is for the Fabian Society and its future?
Thanks, Marie. I think it's hugely important. The Fabian Society predates the Labour Party, and its founding members, George Bernard Shaw, Sydney and Beatrice Webb, their view was to influence change and push for progressive change through parliamentary democracy. So the purpose of the Labour Party is not just to write pamphlets, but to help to influence legislation through the Labour Party so that we can help the lives of millions. So it's fantastic to have Fabian Society members and Fabian Society executive members on the front bench, because it means that Fabian values are going to find its way into policy, and we are in a position now where, you know, we should be, where it's, you know, the Labour Party and the Fabian Society working in tandem to ensure that we have a policy platform that is progressive, that is there to ensure that we have the change that we need in this country. So I think it's a great position for the party. And as chair of the Fabian Society, you know, we'll be working as an executive to ensure that the Fabian Society continues to produce the vital policy publications and conduct the vital research that is needed to lay the foundation for the future platform that we that the party utilises.
Thank you for answering that. And finally, Martin, as the new chair of the Fabian Society, what are your plans for the society in this coming year and also during a pandemic as well?
Yeah, so yeah, as you mentioned, it's challenging times for not only the Fabian Society, but you know the entire nation. So, well, you know, our focus as an executive is ensuring that we deliver for Fabian Society members. We're going to continue to host online and virtual events like we have been doing throughout the pandemic to ensure that members have as much engagement and as much events to attend virtually. We'll be also continuing with our publications in the quarterly magazines as usual. On top of that, we are going to be supporting and continuing to provide support for the various wings of the Fabian Society, so the Young Fabians, the Fabian Women's Network, the local societies, the Scottish and Welsh Fabians, to ensure that they can continue to deliver a programme of events that allows members to be able to access Fabian Society events and materials no matter where they are in the country. And lastly, we have a phenomenal secretariat at the Fabian Society led by the General Secretary, Andy Harrop, who are working tirelessly throughout this pandemic to continue to ensure that we produce and publish the highest quality research and publications, and that will be continuing. And that vital work will help to ensure that the Fabian Society continues to influence public policy and discourse, you know, no matter what, pandemic or no pandemic, Fabian policy events and publications will continue.
There's so much happening, and yeah, I mean, you must be a very busy man, Martin. You've got a year ahead of you.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely privileged to be chair of the Fabian Society. You know, I am enjoying every moment, and for me, what makes me really happy is also seeing the phenomenal work the Young Fabians are doing. You know, it's just amazing to see how much the Young Fabians have grown and how much they thrived during the pandemic. Right now is a really important moment for us to continue thinking, having debates and discussion about what country we want to build post-pandemic.
Yeah,
as I've said, the coronavirus pandemic has shifted the way we not only view ourselves as individuals, but the way we view society. And we have to think about how we wish to rebuild society and how we wish to respond to some of the challenges that the pandemic has thrown up. So, Young Fabians, you have to, you know, continue to think, continue to meet, and continue to produce policy, because that wider discussion will only make our movement stronger.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, 100%. I just want to say, like, to all Young Fabians listening, I mean, you've been doing like incredible work, you know, over the last year, throughout 2020, there were so many amazing things done despite the pandemic, so many great events. But, you know, so many great opportunities for the year ahead. And it's just amazing to have someone like yourself, Martin, coming on and talking about your experience going up through the ranks in the Young Fabians, starting out. I mean, how old were you when you started out? Just quickly.
So when I first joined the Fabian Society and the Young Fabians, I was 20. But I wasn't really super active until I was, you know, around 23, 24. So I sort of just went along to events for a few years, as you do, just sort of, you know, getting, just as a student, you're just sitting, learning, trying to find, you know, research for your essays and whatnot. So I was very active around 23, 24. But what's fantastic about the Young Fabians is that you do have that upper age limit of 31. I aged out of the Young Fabians last year.
Wow.
Funny. So, you know, it's one of those things where the Young Fabians is such an open and engaging space, you know, right up to the age of 31. Even if you're listening and you're over the age of 31, I would say get involved in the Fabian Society as well.
Yeah.
The Fabian Society has loads of different policy groups that you can kind of engage in as well. And one thing that always amazes me is the way in which the Young Fabian networks are thriving, and you've got so many interesting policy networks, and you produce so much policy as well, and it's phenomenal work.
Yeah, I can't keep up with the amount of output from the Young Fabians. Yeah, as I said, it's great to see someone like yourself who joined age 20 as like a fly on the wall, sort of, and now you're the chair of the Fabian Society, and it's a testament to all the great work you've done. And we'll end it there. I just want to wish you the best of luck for the year ahead, Martin. It's great to meet you and chat with you. So yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mary and Louis, for having me. It's been amazing to chat to you both. I'm looking forward to seeing where this podcast goes. Thank you for having me.